Chapter 26. Without doubt, the convening of a grand jury would have been the worst nightmare for anyone complicit in the JFK and Lee Harvey Oswald assassinations. Armed with subpoena powers and an army of investigators who could comb the United States and abroad searching for key witnesses, an independent prosecutor with grand jury intentions was the enemy no one wanted to face if they were somehow involved in the dastardly events in Dallas. That no grand jury was convened in either 1963 or 1964 is no surprise. The stumbling block was none other than J. Edgar Hoover, who proclaimed, as noted, that unless evidence of a conspiracy was uncovered, no convening of a grand jury could happen. This was certainly safe ground for the FBI director, since he had censored any evidence pointing to a conspiracy, as noted, when he first circulated the FBI memo to all concerned on November 24th, 2 days after issuing his directive to agents and the Justice Department. It read, as noted, "Have something issued so that we can convince the American public that Oswald is the real assassin." Hoover, dubbed by Robert Kennedy Jr. a poster child for abuse of power, then ramrodded the Warren Commission into agreeing with his assessment, and perhaps, it may be suggested, deliberately doing so without calling as a witness his chief tormentor, Dorothy May Kilgallen. From the information gathered, it is clear that if she had been called to testify and exposed even a whisper of a conspiracy before the commission, based on her credible investigation, the course of history could have been significantly altered. Instead, Kilgallen was ignored, despite the fact that unless they all lived in a news vacuum, each of the members of the Warren Commission, including Chief Justice Warren, had read her scathing columns posted almost daily, starting just a week after JFK died. They also knew of her much-publicized exposure of the Ruby testimony, an affront to them, since it was supposed to be top secret. Why at least one of the members didn't demand that Kilgallen be called as a witness is mind-boggling. But it's important to remember that the commission was in lockstep with Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamation, and Kilgallen was driving the wrong way on a one-way street against traffic, against Hoover's brainwashing directives. If Kilgallen had unloaded her powerful evidence, including making certain the Warren Commission members actually read closely the Ruby trial transcripts, which included sworn testimony of his friendships with police and D.A. Henry Wade, his posing as a reporter to gain access to the jail basement, and most importantly, that he said he would be there when Oswald was transferred, it is possible to believe that there would be no greatest murder mystery in history. Investigators could have worked backwards, connected Ruby to Marcello, and then Oswald to the Mafia Don, as they wove a blanket of evidence proving Marcello had the most compelling motive to have orchestrated JFK's demise. Noted syndicated columnist Liz Smith, one of Kilgallen's rivals in the 1960s, wrote a column entitled "Strange Case of Dorothy Kilgallen," released nationally on December 15, 1976, and featuring a large photo of Kilgallen. Smith's column revealed that in 1975, both author Lee Israel and Kilgallen's son Kerry had been attempting to wrest from the FBI and CIA the pertinent papers concerning Kilgallen's involvement with the assassination of JFK. Smith said that while Israel sought the papers for a book she was writing, Kerry wanted them because he is mad, frustrated, and wants to find out what his mother knew and how she really died. Smith added that Kerry, who must have believed the official cause of death was suspect, was proud of what he had learned of his mother, and wants the story of her prescience and courage in the matter of JFK's death made public. Without providing a source, Smith swore, "The FBI has voluminous material about Kilgallen." Regarding the CIA, Smith added, "What was this international agency doing investigating a gossip columnist? The CIA had 20-odd pages on Dorothy Kilgallen in its files. It contacted 51 CIA offices in her case. Note, efforts to substantiate this claim have not proven fruitful. In closing, Smith stated, with both the FBI and CIA in the shadows of suspicion and clouds of disgrace, one would think it would behoove them to act quickly and openly and make the Kilgallen dossiers available to her outraged son. But the cover-up continues. The CIA focus on Kilgallen requires a strong look into whether they could have been responsible for her demise. As early as 1951, as noted, she had been on the agency's radar when she alleged radio-free Europe was not free. Kilgallen apparently suspected subversive groups influenced the broadcasts, and the column triggered the agency's interest in her. A subsequent dossier documented Kilgallen's less than cooperative attitude when agents in search of a source for her column entry contacted the protective journalist. Criticisms of Kilgallen prevail throughout the report, including, "She procrastinated until we lost all patience with her." Regarding the agent who hounded her for information, the report stated, "He did everything in his power to get Miss Kilgallen to change her mind about revealing her source, but he despaired of any interest." Kilgallen's friend Mark Lane was suspicious of the CIA. He told friends, "I bet you 1,000 to 1 that the CIA surrounded her as soon as she started writing those stories about the JFK assassination." If the CIA was instrumental in JFK's death, then Kilgallen's condemnation of any and all government proclamations could have swept her into the agency's path once again. However, the only official record in its files that focused on her was generated 14 years before her death. Connecting the agency as a strong suspect is thus less than viable unless new evidence surfaces. New hope for some breakthrough regarding the assassination arose in 1976 when, as mentioned, the United States House of Representatives Select Committee on Assassinations, or HSCA, was established. Its purpose was to investigate the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. by considering new evidence that had appeared since 1963. The HSCA completed its investigation in 1978. 1 year later, its final report was issued. The HSCA report wasn't aimed at the CIA, but severely criticized the Justice Department, at the time headed by Robert Kennedy, for having largely abdicated what should have been important responsibilities in the continuing investigation. It then added, "Officials at Justice did not exercise any significant role in shaping, monitoring, or evaluating the FBI's investigation, despite the Bureau's organization status with the department." Continuing the criticism, the report also said there was little indication Justice Department officials moved to mount a sophisticated criminal investigation of the assassination, including its conspiracy, emphasis added, implications. It added that the department failed to use its power and capabilities of a federal grand jury and the granting of immunity. Most importantly, the committee decided Hoover was wrong when he proclaimed that federal jurisdiction did not exist over the assassination because there was no evidence of a conspiracy in 1963, thus prohibiting the convening of a grand jury. To the contrary, the report stated that evidence did exist regarding a conspiracy and that a grand jury should have been convened. In addition, the report blasted Robert Kennedy's mental state in that it significantly affected the government's handling of the investigation. It also chastised him for failure to advance a strong position with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover on the course of the investigation. The HSCA conclusions reached in the late 1970s mirror what would have occurred after November 1965 if Kilgallen had lived and published her account of the evidence she had gathered during her 18-month investigation. This, in turn, would have triggered the call for convening a grand jury investigation, one possessing evidence-gathering tools as a grand jury, and grants of immunity, as noted by the committee. Amazingly enough, there appears to be little focus by the committee on the discrepancies Kilgallen knew existed between what the Warren Commission report investigated and then reported, and the testimony she had heard at Jack Ruby's trial. An examination of the 686-page HSCA report provides no indication that the committee ever read the trial transcripts, the alarming testimony about Ruby's actions before he shot Oswald. Such failure causes real doubt as to whether the HSCA investigation was any more effective or truthful than the woeful Warren Commission. The videotaped interviews with Kilgallen's hairdressers, Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson, are truly part of history and should be preserved for the ages. Since there is little doubt that Kilgallen's first-hand accounts of the twin assassinations are worthy of the Pulitzer Prize, the hairdresser's primary source accounts provide the necessary insight into the mind of a brilliant woman who had no equal then and perhaps even now in the journalistic and investigative reporting fields. Simpson had a special affection for the gifted journalist. Mark Sinclair had introduced them. Over time, Simpson became Kilgallen's trusted friend. During the recorded interview in the late 1990s, he said Kilgallen was even gracious to the girls at the desk, all the small people, a reference to the popular Lily Dachet's Midtown Manhattan Salon for Ladies. He added, "I've never known this woman, Dorothy, to be mean in any way." He also said, "Dorothy had a rosary, a pearl rosary, and she would take it out on the second floor of her townhouse, a 5-story Georgian mansion. And what she did was go out, and there was a little hedge on there, and she would lay the rosary out there when Mark or I flew anywhere and leave it there until we returned. And she told us she did this." Wearing a bright golf shirt while chain-smoking, the balding and mustachioed Simpson spoke deliberately during his interviews. Available at www.thedorothykilgallenstory.org. He paused and reflected before answering questions about Kilgallen. When the interviewer attempted to get him to agree with a statement, and he did not, Simpson held his ground. The hairdresser, who also handled Kilgallen's makeup chores, recalled she was smart enough to go only so far and not cross the line when dishing criticism of celebrities and public figures. Simpson also said that when it came to really big stuff, Kilgallen did not pull any punches when necessary. But when there was someone who really needed to be exposed for something they were doing, government people, things like that, she pulled no punches. He added, "It wasn't like today, when if celebrities have fungus under their fingernails, the media exposes it. There was an unwritten law then, and Dorothy knew the limitations." Simpson, who stated, "I've never seen her in a Sunday night show when she wasn't alert and with it. Remember the days when I fixed her hair every Sunday before What's My Line?" He said that he and Mark Sinclair both had keys to Kilgallen's townhouse, so they could wake her without waking up the servants. Simpson said the night she died, Mark had done her hair for the show, and she was taking a plane to London the next day. This is why I find it very hard to believe that she committed suicide, for the simple fact that she was looking forward to this trip to London the next morning, and Mark went over very, very early in order to get her ready for the plane trip to London, and that's when he found her. Simpson said that Kilgallen never quit investigating, never quit, when it came to going full bore toward learning the truth about the assassinations. He provided critical information when he stated, "She dug up something about the assassination of President Kennedy that somebody didn't want her to know, because she even told us of her own volition. I used to share things with you guys, but after I have found out now what I know, if the wrong people knew what I know, it would cost me my life." And she was dead about 9 months later. Regarding the Jack Ruby Warren Commission testimony, Simpson said, She printed it on the front page of the Journal American before the president received it, and therein lies the tale. From then on, we were stalked. Mark and me, our phones were tapped, since they were trying to figure out where she got her information. That she could get this information before the president got it. This was because, Simpson said. Actually, even though I didn't know anything about the assassination, these people, whoever they were, didn't know that. They didn't know what Dorothy may have told us. And yes, I kept it to myself and denied everything until recent years. Asked if it was safe to talk about it at the time of the interview, Simpson paused and then replied, No. During the audiotaped interview of John Broich, the medical examiner toxicologist who, along with Dr. Charles Umberger, discovered the three barbiturates in Kilgallen's system in 1968, the interviewer told him, Mark Sinclair was very frightened when I contacted him. I had to calm him down. During another interview, the interviewer stated, Sinclair told me a very frightening story in which people threatened his life, and he had to keep quiet. On one specific occasion, Simpson declared that someone followed Sinclair and him. He said, Four men in expensive suits tried to force him into a room, but I refused. He added, When I got back to my room at the Pickwick Arms, someone had gone through all my things, and that he and Sinclair joked that it was either the Mafia or CIA. Sinclair, speaking carefully about Kilgallen and her intention to gather enough evidence exposing those involved in JFK's assassination, corroborated Simpson's account of Kilgallen's steadfast pursuit of the truth, a path fraught with danger. Sinclair was asked why he finally spoke about Kilgallen after several decades. He answered, I was terrified to talk about this. When Lee Israel called and told me about her book, I wouldn't talk to her at all 10 years after. I was still having problems. Asked why he decided to finally talk about his friend, Sinclair, pausing to think before answering, stated, Now everyone is dead or older than I am, so I don't think it makes much difference. Commenting on why others had refused to question how and why Kilgallen died, he stated, They wouldn't have, because you could wind up dead. At the outset of the interview, Sinclair examined a newspaper front page featuring a headline touting Kilgallen's exposure of Jack Ruby's Warren Commission testimony, and then commented, That's when the heat really started. That's when my phones were bugged. People started following us, he and Simpson. It wasn't very good after that. He also said, Everything was done to discredit Dorothy after she wrote about the assassinations, to degrade her. True to Sinclair's words was the insinuation that Kilgallen was somehow anti-Semitic. Rumors of this allegation had first surfaced around 1947, when a strange series of events caused her to be looked upon with great displeasure. How it began had nothing to do with her. As the account goes, May Kilgallen was indeed anti-Semitic. She refused to take young Dickie Kolmar to the Bronx Zoo, since it was packed with Jewish people, and she was uncomfortable around them. Apparently, one morning when Dickie was included in the Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick radio show, which was live and not taped, Dickie blurted out something to the effect, Grandma won't take me to the Bronx Zoo since she hates Jews. Predictably, there was a huge backlash to the statement, but somehow it connected to Dorothy instead of May. At the time, there was a New York paper called PM that purported to be for the 99%, with its motto, PM is against people who push other people around. PM is one newspaper that can and dares to tell the truth. It was started by Ralph Ingersoll, given credit for being the editorial whiz behind Life, Fortune, and Time magazines. The newspaper lasted for 8 years, 1940 to 1948. The anti-Semitic story made the rounds and apparently was mentioned in PM. It recirculated when Kilgallen died, a black mark, undeserved. Regardless, Sinclair recalled, Dorothy wouldn't stop with the JFK assassination investigation. She had it all. She told me about this. And Donald Simpson was there, too, and he knew. We knew what she was doing. He added, she said this was the case of a lifetime, a story of a lifetime, that she would prove who assassinated the president. Regarding the Ruby Warren Commission testimony, Sinclair said, what Dorothy did was like slapping them, the government, in the face. Brenda DeJordan said her father, mother and she, and her brother Larry knew what the famous journalist's investigation was all about. During exclusive interviews with this author in June 2017, she provided the following information. Most of what DeJordan recalled is based on conversations with her father and mother at the time, and thus its accuracy must be considered in that light, although there appears no motive for her to exaggerate or tell untruths. My parents knew Dorothy was doing research about the JFK assassination. She used to have my dad take articles to the newspaper when a courier didn't do it. My father took Dorothy's articles to the newspaper office in an envelope. He did not read them. I remember my father telling Dorothy, "Be careful. Let Jack Ruby alone." My father was fearful of her safety. Dorothy didn't believe JFK was killed the way they said he was. She thought it was a government cover-up and set out to investigate it. I rode with my father to the office when he took her articles there for her. Dorothy was very excited about what she was doing with the JFK assassination investigation. She relied a lot on my father, but was very secretive about it all. One time my father said to Dorothy, "Do you think it's safe to do all this with the JFK assassination investigation?" My father started to worry when she exposed the whole Ruby deal with the Warren Commission. He warned her, "Don't open up a can of worms. You are putting yourself in jeopardy." My father said to Dorothy, "For your safety, let it go. Let it alone, the JFK assassination. Only going to open up problems." I heard him say, "These are dangerous people." My father was very concerned for Dorothy's safety. I know Mark Sinclair had a conversation with my father about Dorothy's JFK assassination investigation. Mark said, "I told her to leave it alone." The final statement by DeJordan confirms that from day one of Kilgallen's JFK and Oswald assassination investigation, both Sinclair and Clement, arguably her closest friends, were concerned for the one woman in the world they admired the most. Each loved Dorothy and was scared for her, realizing she was playing a dangerous game with powerful forces who could silence her with one phone call. Kilgallen's daughter Jill, in a 2017 interview with the New York Post's Susan Edelman, said, "My mom was a very curious person, and there was a time when I felt our phones were being tapped, but it didn't faze me. It had to do with her coverage of Jack Ruby." Jill added, "But mother was not scared, not knee-knocking during the JFK assassination investigation. This account differs from those provided by several others, including Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson." That Jill was aware of Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation was confirmed through Ruby co-counsel Joe Tonahill, who recalled speaking to Jill when he called Kilgallen with information about the Ruby case after his trial. Tonahill said Jill was very bright and talked to him until her mother could come to the phone. Citing the rumors swirling about JFK's assassination, Sinclair stated in his videotaped interview, "People were saying there was more to this than meets the eye. Maybe the government did it, killed JFK. Maybe President Johnson's people did it. People would ask me questions because I knew Dorothy, and they would want to know. Charlotte Ford, Henry Ford's daughter, wanted to know. Mr. Levitt, a famous developer, William Levitt was called the father of modern American suburbia, wanted to know. He would ask me questions when I went to do his wife's hair." Sinclair believed he was invited to people's homes to try to pump me, find out what they could find out from me. "I wouldn't say anything about Dorothy, and I knew Donald Simpson wouldn't. We were very close-mouthed on it." Regarding Phyllis Cerf, Bennett's wife, Sinclair added, I did her hair. I didn't like her very much. She was always asking me how Dorothy died. Asked what he said, Sinclair replied, I never told anyone until now, not even Lee Israel. Kilgallen's friend Marlon Swing agreed that Kilgallen had learned a great deal from the Ruby testimony and was targeted for doing so. That's when the phones were tapped, he said, when they were trying to figure out how she had gotten her information. Regarding Swing's reputation, in a letter dated October 5, 1995, Walter Cronkite was quoted as saying, I have known Marlon Swing for many years, and am certain that he is highly credible and honest, although I have never discussed with him and know nothing of his experiences or theories regarding the Kilgallen death. Brenda DeJordan's first-hand accounts of her father's interactions with Kilgallen regarding the JFK and Oswald assassinations certainly ring true, based on the observations of Mark Sinclair and Charles Simpson. Obviously, those closest to Kilgallen not only were quite aware of the intensity of her JFK and Oswald assassination investigations, but also the danger she faced during the final days of her life. Each attempted, it appears, to warn her of that danger, loving her as they did. Dorothy Kilgallen believed that the information she had learned about the JFK and Oswald assassinations placed her life in danger. Words from the mouth of Melvin Belli confirm she was right. During this author's research for King of the Courtroom, the lone biography of Belli, published in 2007, Dr. Martin Shore, a good friend of Belli, recalled that shortly after Kilgallen died, Belli said, They've killed Dorothy. Now they'll go after Ruby. After Ruby died of cancer on July 3, 1967, Belli told office manager Carol Ann Lind, Something's not right. Maybe they injected Ruby with cancer cells. Belli's law partner, Seymour Ellison, told this author Belli said the same thing to him many times. Predictably, questions abound, such as whether the they Belli mentioned regarding they've killed Dorothy and they injected Ruby were the same they Robert Kennedy noted shortly after learning of JFK's death. I thought they would get one of us. I thought it would be me. Or the they should have killed me, part of the statement RFK made to presidential confidant Ken O'Donnell. In 2017, New York City attorney and radio talk show host Matthew Mira passed along information regarding a longtime Kilgallen assistant at the Journal American named Danny Brooks. Apparently for a short time, Kilgallen worked out of a glass-enclosed cubicle there. She was assisted by Brooks, described as a cigar-chewing, dwarfish man, who wore pinky rings on several fingers, fooled canonically with his omnipresent rosary beads, and called Dorothy the boss. Brooks apparently was loyal to a fault, cluing in Kilgallen about all of the office gossip, who liked her, and who she should watch out for, since they weren't fans. Mira told this author he lived in the Knickerbocker neighborhood, across from the newspaper offices, and became friends with Brooks. When Dorothy died, Mira said, I saw Danny crying. I asked why. He said they killed her. They effing killed her. She talked too much about Ruby, the interviews, her biggest case. Mira added, Danny said they, the authorities, said she died of drinking too much, and she liked to drink, but not that much. It isn't real. When Mira asked Brooks why he didn't go to the police, he informed this author that Brooks told him, Are you crazy? Think I want to die too? Brooks' paranoia was apparently well-founded. Consider a statement made by mafioso Frank Sturgis, one of the Watergate burglars, in 1977 to Morita Lorenz, a German-born American woman who had an affair with Fidel Castro in 1959. And, in 1960, was involved in an assassination attempt by the CIA on Castro's life. We were walking down York Avenue in New York City, and Sturgis was bragging about all of his exploits. He said, We can kill anybody we want. Just blame it on national security. He said columnist Dorothy Kilgallen got whacked because of her intention to publish a book which included information from her exclusive interview with Jack Ruby.